You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 24th of November 2021 on Monocle 24, The Globalist, in association with UBS. Hello, this is The Globalist coming to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead, Sweden's about to get a new prime minister. We'll discuss if the country will see its first female leader later today. And
in terms of what does a weaker lira mean for the economy, it means the fact is the central bank is all but useless in its attempts to stimulate growth, right? And we're seeing that here.
The Turkish lira continues a sharp downward spiral, exacerbated by Erdogan's remarks about cutting interest rates. Can this unorthodox approach ever work? Plus, Eric Zemmour, the French far-right writer, who's widely believed to be contemplating a run at the presidency, has been in London and Geneva. We'll ask why his welcome was less than ecstatic. And
oh, this is interesting. There's a voting system here where visitors can vote. What are you willing to share? Are you willing to share a garden, a car, a washing machine, an electric drill, or a bath? I assume sharing the bath not while other people are in it, not that kind of sharing a bath.
No. I'm all for sharing water and a bath. It just depends who's in it. We'll get a take on the papers from Emma in Zurich, a hit of urbanism news, and we'll find out how Finland is revolutionising the postal service. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. South Korea has experienced record daily COVID cases just weeks after the country's reopening. In a move likely to antagonise China, Joe Biden has invited Taiwan to his Summit for Democracy next month. And 5 years after its peace deal with the Colombian government, FARC is expected to be removed from the US government's terror list. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, very shortly, we will know if Sweden has its first female prime minister, as the parliament votes this morning on who will replace Stefan Löfven. The Social Democrat leader, Magdalena Andersson, has been trying to shore up enough votes. The outcome is far from assured. It seems like the Left Party has given her their backing, but the finer details are still to be rearranged. Well, Charlie Duxbury is Politico's correspondent in Stockholm and joins me down the line. Charlie, Andersson has won the backing of the Left Party, but can you explain how this process worked?
Yeah, hi there. Good morning. So, yeah, as you say, Parliament is set to vote from around 9 o'clock this morning, Swedish time. And it looks like the would-be Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson of the Social Democrats has secured support of her erstwhile allies, the Left Party, to be Sweden's first female Prime Minister. It's quite a convoluted process to get there. Under the Swedish system, you need to have a majority. There cannot be a majority against you, is the way the Swedish system works. So that means that Magdalena Andersson needs the support of her own Social Democrats, the Green Party, the Left Party, and the Centre Party. At the very least, need to not be against her, and then she should be able to just about edge over the line.
Mm-hmm. And what were the conversations with the Left Party to get that backing? Do we have any detail?
Yeah, it seemed to, there were various questions that the Left Party focused on over the past couple of weeks or so when it emerged that Magdalena Andersson would be the Social Democrats' candidate for Prime Minister. They very quickly said that there were a number of things that they wanted to renegotiate as part of their kind of loose cooperation deal with the Social Democrats. It all, in the end, boiled down, it seems, to pensions, and the Left Party wanted to see higher pensions for the least well-off sections of the older population in Sweden. And it seems like they got enough out of last night's negotiation with Andersson's team that they're happy to support her this morning.
Mm. And of course, the first vote this morning is the budget, which is her next hurdle. Do you think that will pass? And what are the alternatives?
Yeah, the budget vote will be this afternoon. That also looks like being a very tight call. We probably won't know how that will go until very soon ahead of the vote or during the vote itself. It's not a given that the government's version of the budget will pass. If it doesn't, an opposition budget may pass, which would leave Anderson, if she is appointed as Prime Minister, governing for a first period of her term, using somebody else's spending plans, which wouldn't be a great start.
Mm. What's the position of the Centre Party?
Yeah, well, traditionally over recent years, they've been part of the sort of centre-right grouping, which has been the opposition to the Social Democrat-led centre-left option. And they, as the centre-right, have kind of reconfigured and begun to warm to the idea of having the far-right Sweden Democrats as part of their grouping in Parliament. The Centre Party have backed away from that and said that they won't work with the Sweden Democrats. That's left them either potentially isolated in Parliament or with this option of teaming up with the centre-left under the Social Democrats. It's quite an awkward mix of partners for the Social Democrats, because they've got the left party on one side who are ideologically quite different from the Centre Party. Centre Party are traditionally as kind of liberal, pro-market, pro-agricultural sector party. They've got their roots in kind of Swedish agricultural groups. The Left Party are a traditional more workers' party, high tax, big state kind of option.
Mm. And in terms of the very far right, which of course has its roots within the Nazi Party, how much support do they have?
Yeah, I mean, they're proving resilient in the polls. Sweden has an election slated for next September, and the Sweden Democrats are looking strong ahead of that, somewhere around 20% support. And with that in mind, the centre-right main opposition party, the Moderates, have decided to kind of embrace the Sweden Democrats to a greater extent than they have in the past, and kind of form a loose cooperation with them to kind of build what they hope will be more support than what the current government can muster in less than 12 months' time. Mm.
Can you tell us a little bit more about Andersson? I mean, what's her background and what will the government look like under her leadership?
Yeah, so she is, she's from a town called Uppsala, which is just north of Stockholm. She trained as an economist, kind of a behind-the-scenes player in the Social Democratic Party in the 90s, then took a step back to run be a senior figure in the tax office here, which is an important position. Then was called up by Stefan Löfven, who's the outgoing prime minister, to be his kind of shadow finance minister. And then when Löfven won the election in 2014, Andersson became the finance minister, a position she's held since then. She's been seen as an effective operator. I mean, she's not rated as a hugely charismatic speaker, but then the finance minister position doesn't necessarily lend itself to that kind of those opportunities to kind of entertain the audience. It's more about getting the facts and figures over and putting your side of the debate on the financial side of things and making that clear as best you can to voters. So it remains to be seen what kind of leader she'll be if she gets the top job today.
I mean, given Sweden's very equal society, is it surprising that it's taken so long to get a woman prime minister?
I mean, it is if you compare with other Nordic states where, you know, they've had female leaders have been a kind of regular regular thing for many years. Sweden has set itself up as a kind of advocate for women's rights and has it said it had a feminist foreign policy and has pushed that for many years and kind of made a big play of that. And I guess not ever having had a female leader, that's sort of undermined that message slightly. So, you know, on some level, it is a big deal for Sweden that this may happen now.
Yeah, and we'll certainly find out all about it in around about an hour's time. Charlie Duxbury in Stockholm there. Thank you very much. Turkey. Turkey's currency crisis has deepened as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan stood behind his policy of cutting interest rates to fight inflation. It's a view at odds with several of his previous finance ministers, as well as the general orthodoxy. And analysts warn it could lead to a run on the banks. Hannah Lucinda Smith is the Istanbul correspondent for The Times and joins me now. Hannah, the lira has been in freefall for a while. Can you tell us how this situation first arose?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you say, I mean, the lira has been on a kind of slow and steady decline almost for the past decade. But really, that's speeded up since 2018 when President Erdogan won the latest round of elections in Turkey and the system changed from parliamentary democracy to a presidential, executive presidential system. Now, that gives Erdogan a huge amount of control over all sorts of institutions, including, as it has emerged, the central bank. Since that shift, he has fired several central bank governors and other key officials within the central bank who have disagreed with his extremely unorthodox economic theory that high interest rates cause high inflation. Now, of course, what most economists, almost all economists, will say is that the exact opposite is true. If you want to bring inflation down, you have to raise interest rates. And of course, the central bank, under almost the complete command of Erdogan in Turkey, has been doing exactly the opposite. It's been slashing and slashing the interest rates. And as a result, we've seen the lira, particularly over the past couple of weeks and particularly yesterday, just absolutely crashing through the floor.
Well, what's his rationale for this position?
Well, I mean, one thing is, as we say, this is kind of very, very unorthodox economic theory. But also, there is, let's say, some kind of method behind his madness. There's two industries that he thinks will be really, really helped by this. One is construction. Construction industry is massively important to Erdogan. A, because he gets an enormous amount of support from very powerful businessmen in that sector. And B, it's a very, very easy way to kind of make the economy look like it's still in growth. If you keep the credit flowing, if you keep people buying houses, keep that industry moving, then you get the impression of growth even when everything else is really in dire straits. And the second thing which he has said is that, you know, if the lira is weak, it makes Turkey more competitive, A, for exports and B, for tourism. Now, there's a major flaw in that, which is that Turkey imports a lot of its raw materials and energy. So when it comes to exports, it's only the things which are entirely, you know, manufactured at home in Turkey, which is almost nothing, no components brought in from outside or anything, that are going to be competitive. And when it comes to tourism, you know, hotel owners, resort owners are in a terrible, terrible position at the moment because they're trying to set their prices for the coming summer for 2022. But of course, that depends on all sorts of things, you know, how much food is going to cost, how much energy is going to cost. And they just don't know at this point because inflation is so, so rampant. And of course, you know, these costs are going to be passed on to the people who take their holidays in Turkey. So if your inflation is rampant, it doesn't mean cheap holidays at all.
And what does it mean for ordinary Turks financially?
It's absolutely devastating. I mean, Turks with savings in lira are just seeing, you know, the value of those savings, you know, crumble in compared to other currencies. So, you know, anyone who kind of is planning to take a holiday abroad or anything like that, clearly, you know, just seeing that absolutely crumble. Businesses that have loans to pay back in foreign currency, they're facing really big problems as well. But I mean, the main thing is just every time that you go into the shops in Turkey, the prices are going up and up and up. You can feel it. You don't even have to look at, you know, the figures, the official figures. You can feel it. And, you know, it's all that Turks are talking about at the moment. You know, how can they run businesses like this? How can they plan household budgets like this? It's just a really, really insecure, unstable, worrying time for Turks.
And how have foreign investors reacted?
I mean, unsurprisingly, you know, the flight of foreign investment is something that started quite a few years back, but has really, really ramped up. Again, you know, how can you invest in businesses when you just don't know how those businesses are going to be able to pay back their foreign debt? You know, when an economy is basically being run by one man with an extremely unorthodox view of economics. So, you know, even up until earlier this year, when the lira was recovering slightly, there were more kind of, let's say, brave or, you know, investors willing to take risks, who were still looking at Turkey as a risky but potentially lucrative investment. But now I think that's just completely out the window.
I mean, you mentioned that he's had to get rid of some central bank officials and finance ministers and so on. How much is his position being opposed from within his own ranks?
I mean, there's certainly no open opposition. And, you know, at this point, the circle around Erdogan is very tight and very, very loyal. I mean, even people who were very powerful up to a few years ago, thinking particularly of his spokesman, Ibrahim Kalin, who's very well respected, you know, an Erdogan loyalist, but a very, very worldly guy. He got his PhD in the US, speaks fluent English. You know, people like that even have been sidelined. And, you know, clearly anyone who kind of speaks out or disagrees with him at this point just loses their job. So, you know, we're hearing opposition clearly from other parties, other political leaders in Turkey who are calling for early elections. We're hearing criticism coming from former central bank governors, but from within the central bank itself and certainly within Erdogan's circle, we're not hearing anything like that.
And so what might the political implications be?
I mean, I think they are going to be absolutely huge and, you know, perhaps, you know, politically fatal for Erdogan. It's really, really interesting to compare this scenario now to the one 20 years ago when Turkey went through a similar currency crisis and inflation crisis. That spelled the end for the ruling coalition at the time, and it cleared the way for Erdogan's party, the AKP, to take power. And they came in on a promise of sorting out the economy. Well, things have come absolutely full circle now. You know, and now Erdogan is the one who's looking like he's completely crushed Turkey's economy, like he needs to be sort of moved out of the way in order for a fresh start to begin. It's not by coincidence that all the opposition parties are really calling every day now for early elections. The elections are scheduled for 2023. They're saying they just need to be called early. There needs to be some kind of, you know, public vote of confidence on what's going on here.
But given his absolute grip on power, is there a chance he would be voted out?
I think certainly in free and fair elections, all the polls are showing that he would absolutely be voted out. Now, the question is whether or not he's going to give up power easily. He's got an enormous amount of control over the institutions of state, including institutions like the Supreme Electoral Board. He's showed in the past that he's willing to use that power to influence decisions. On the other hand, Turkey is a country with a really proud and quite strong democratic tradition. You know, people are, you know, very, very kind of committed to democracy in Turkey and committed to the idea of democracy and the idea that, you know, a leader would just not recognize elections or you stay in power despite losing is, you know, something that's never happened before in Turkey. And I think we'll be entering, you know, quite dangerous territory if that was to happen. Mm.
And presumably they would. I mean, there's an awful lot of foreign interest given Turkey's strategic importance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Turkey is not, you know, your typical kind of economic basket case country. It's not like Venezuela or Iran or North Korea or any of these countries because, A, it's a member of NATO. It's a G20 country. It's still an EU candidate country, as crazy as it is to think about that. And it occupies this position, you know, right in the middle of Europe and some of the world's most troubled places. And, you know, we're seeing what Alexander Lukashenko is doing in Belarus now. Well, let's not forget that he got that idea from Erdogan. It was Erdogan who last year, you know, openly opened his borders with Greece, land borders, and tried to herd refugees through to try and pressure European policy. So, you know, this is not a country that, you know, we can just turn our backs on and say, OK, it's a basket case, whatever. It's really, really important to European security.
Mm. But so, I mean, Erdogan pushing the self-destruct button, in effect, could be a good thing for Turkish citizens and indeed the rest of the world.
But certainly not in the short term. I mean, the amount of economic suffering here is huge. And I think one kind of really kind of key thing to note is that, you know, if we flash back to 2013, nearly 9 years ago in Turkey, there were those huge street protests against President Erdogan, the Gezi Park protests. Now, the difference with now is that people are just too scared. There's been such a crackdown on the opposition. There's been such a kind of seizing of control of the institutions of state by Erdogan that, you know, although there were some protests last night, they were very, very small scale. And I think, you know, people are not seeing this in a positive light. I think everybody sort of realizes that even if this is the end game for Erdogan, it's not going to be an easy or smooth transition. I think, you know, Turkey, unfortunately, is going to face a lot more chaos before, you know, brighter days come around.
Hannah Lucinda Smith in Istanbul. Thank you very much indeed. Now, still to come on the programme, we head to Copenhagen for an architecture exhibition and see what's making the news in Zurich. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Officially, the French writer and would-be politician Eric Zemmour is not yet running for the presidency, but according to Politico's poll of polls, he is on course for 15% of the vote in the first round. That's just behind his right-wing rival Marine Le Pen on 17%, with the incumbent Emmanuel Macron on 24%. Well, Zemmour was in London last weekend, ostensibly on a book tour, but also apparently trying to drum up funds from the expat community for his tilt at the top job. But it wasn't all plain sailing. AFP journalist in Paris, Florence Biedermann, joins me now. Florence, lovely to speak to you again. Can we start off with a brief recap of just who Zemmour is? I mean, he's been sentenced twice for inciting hatred in France. So what's his background and his view of the world?
Hi, Georgina. Nice to talk to you again. Well, he is, first of all, he's a journalist. He's of an Algerian Jewish family who has left Algeria after the Algerian War. I think it's kind of important in his background. He has been trying twice to integrate this prestige school of administration that have given the background of so many politicians in France, and he failed. And I don't know if it's the reason why, like he has a kind of extreme bitterness on France, on the state of France. And he started his career in journalism, and he has always been a journalist. He has no experience in politics, and he became a polemicist. Like you could see him in various shows, and he's quite good at talking, at joking. And now, since a few years, his obsession, and this is how he describes himself, his obsession has been immigration and the fact that France's identity is threatened by the flood of migrants, especially from North Africa, especially Muslim, who are, in his words, invading France. So now he became this kind of politician centering his talks only about immigration, and that brought him kind of a success.
Mm. I mean, but as we say, he's actually been sentenced for that.
Yeah, because all these years, his talk had been so extreme that twice he has been sentenced for inciting to racial hatred. He has, I think, another five or six procedures still going on. Recently, he has been sentenced, but he appealed for slandering migrant underage people. So, I mean, it goes on and on, provoking, and again, justice is condemning him regularly.
Mm. Now, he's been in London and Geneva in the last few days. Why this attempt to drum up support from abroad? How important is the diaspora?
Well, I mean, every candidate has, for a presidential election at least, has to have some kind of clout, international clout. So that's what he's trying to build. That's one of the reasons, you know, because, yes, okay, I'm obsessed with immigration and France, etc., but I have to build some kind of a more extended image of myself. So that would be one of the reasons. And the second, of course, would be to drum up for financial support, which doesn't seem to start well, because I don't think this was really successful in London. The point is, if you are a banker, if you work in finance, you want to know what is the manifesto of Eric Zemmour on the economic side. And he had not said anything on that so far. So he's welcomed by the potential financier with kind of, a lot of caution, because nobody really knows what he stands for in economics.
Mm, and the French banks, of course, understandably, as you say, not prepared to lend. How was he received in London? I mean, he seems to have a major beef with the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan.
I think he has a major beef with most of the mayor around, except the one that have the same ideas of him, and luckily they are not that many. No, Sadiq Khan said people incited to racial hatred were not welcome, and he was supposed to have this meeting in the Royal Institute, and they cancelled at the last minute, and he had to make his meeting in a small room in an Ibis hotel. The same applies for Geneva. Like, he's going to Geneva today, and again the mayor, the ecologist mayor, said he was not welcome. I don't see any, serious mayor welcoming somebody inciting racial hatred. So what I understand now is there are also maybe some demonstrations waiting for him in Geneva, because the guy is so, polarizing and so openly anti-Muslim, anti-migrant, that of course his presence is making people react.
And what are his views on the European Union?
He's against, of course. I think he's against everything, apart from the purity of France and I don't know what. So he welcomed Brexit, on this, this is great. You get rid of those European bureaucrats. So that's how he views Europe, something against the sovereignty of France.
Mm. Now, Politico's poll had him at 15%. Could he be a serious contender?
Well, he's going down in the polls now. I mean, there was a series of polls where he would go. Can you trust really the polls? I don't know. If you talk about polls, he's really now more around 12%. And it seems the point was, could he access the second round? Meaning, could he fare better than Marine Le Pen? Mm. Because they are more or less on the same patch, extreme right. Although he is more extreme than she is. So now he seems he may not reach the second round. And if you ask me, I don't think he will. Because, if he really starts campaigning, which he has not done, he's not even officially a candidate now. If he starts campaigning, if he has to discuss his program, his economic program, his social program, I think everybody will start to see the king is naked, like there is not much substance apart from this anti-immigration obsession. Mm. So it seems his popularity, or whatever you call it, people could like the way he talks, but it doesn't seem they would trust him to lead France.
Mm. And as you say, he hasn't actually declared his candidacy yet, but he has a rally in Paris, I think, on the 5th of December. Is that when he might announce?
Yeah, that's certainly the case, because it will be in a big room. Like, it's kind of a place where you have rock concerts, etc., Zenith. And this is definitely when he will announce his candidacy, because if he waits too long, now it seems again that his campaigning is losing a bit of impetus, so he has to declare he's a candidate, and that will most probably be the day.
Florence Biedermann in France, thanks very much indeed. And here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. South Korea has experienced record daily COVID cases just weeks after the country's reopening. Prime Minister Kim Boo-kyum has said that the emergency measures may now be imposed to combat the spike. In a move likely to antagonize China, Joe Biden has invited Taiwan to his summit for democracy next month. China classifies the democratically ruled island as part of its territory. 5 years after its peace deal with the Colombian government, FARC is expected to be removed from the US government's terror list. The once feared group has struggled to transform into a legitimate political party, in large part due to restrictions imposed by this listing. And finally, New Zealand has announced it will reopen its borders to vaccinated travellers for the first time since the beginning of the pandemic. It will initially open to New Zealanders in Australia at the beginning of next year, and then the rest of the world by late April. And that's the news here on Monocle 24. Living Better Lives, a new exhibition at Copenhagen's Danish Architecture Centre, opened this month, celebrating the 50th anniversary of pioneering local architecture studio Van Kunsten. It explores the company's focus on smaller, more sustainable homes with communal living spaces and, among other things, its attempts to convince Danes to live with a smaller physical footprint. As well as this, there are long-time champions of the sharing economy, including our correspondent Michael Booth's final sharing economy frontier, a bathroom. To find out more about the brand and the exhibition, Michael went along to talk to curator Sarah Hattler.
I think that for people maybe would want to scale down, you have to also see that you don't just sacrifice something, you also gain a lot. We're trying to inspire people to live or to get the thought that maybe living more sustainable isn't about sacrificing things. Maybe you can gain something. And here in the exhibition, you can actually try on your own body how it would feel like to be in a smaller apartment or house, like a minimal home. And you can try and see and imagine, is that something that I could maybe would want for myself and my family? But besides that, it's also just like a really good and thorough introduction to Van Kunsten, which is like one of the most important studios in Denmark because they've been here for so long and they've done a lot for what we call almenboliger.
Social housing.
Social housing, like a lot of social housing that you see are kind of based on some of the ground principles of Van Kunsten.
We're in the main exhibition space, and it's filled with, it looks like almost like a children's castle play area. It's something playful, yeah. A lot of plywood and plexiglass and rusting corrugated steel plants. What are we looking at?
Well, actually, everything in this exhibition is made out of recycled material. So a lot of the things came from Genbyg.
The recycling center.
Yeah. And that's something that's very important for Van Kunsten, is to recycle, to have architecture be more circular.
So that they're not afraid and never been afraid of their buildings looking a bit used or beaten up or imperfect. It's not about polish and perfection with Van Kunsten.
No, it's the opposite. They really like it. They want it to be like patinated and that you can kind of see that history is written into the material that has been used. And at the same time, I think that's also a big part of the reason why we wanted to create an entire village that you can walk around and where you can enter the houses, is that we wanted people to feel what it feels like to be surrounded by wood and all these like materials that have patina. One of the buildings in the exhibition is the minimal home, and that's like a 37 square meter
yeah.
home made for an entire family, like for four people.
One thing that occurs to me standing here is Van Kunsten was formed around about the same year as Christiania.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a bit of a Christiania vibe about this? It looks like something that could have been plucked from Christiania.
Yeah, that's what I've heard that before. Yeah, well, that's true. I think they really like the idea of chance also in the building and mistakes because it makes architecture more human.
Mm-hmm. Should we go and have a look inside one of the buildings?
This is the minimal home. This is meant as a proper house for four people. And then obviously you would have maybe a community house where you could have like a birthday party. So you would have some shared facilities because you cannot have like, you can't throw a big
You can't really have guests in here.
Party in here. Well, so, you can have guests, but maybe not 10 of them.
So we're standing in what's effectively, is this the bedroom? It's not, there's a mattress on a raised wooden platform.
Yeah, that's like the bedroom. But then when you come into the kitchen, there's another bed that you can fold out from the wall. And you can also use the benches there as sleeping spaces. So
it's like a little corridor. We pass the bed on the left, and then there's a desk area. And there's lots of storage on our right-hand side with shelving, wardrobe for hanging clothes, more cupboard space. Where's the bathroom?
It's in here.
Oh, that's the bathroom, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, with an avocado sink. That's very clearly...
That's very retro, yeah.
Upcycled.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's a shower. We don't have baths in Denmark.
No, just showers, yeah. Yeah.
And this is actually... I've seen some Copenhagen apartments where this is quite a large bathroom.
Yeah, it's quite... luxurious. I would say that I think that for people too, maybe would want to scale down, you have to also see that you don't just sacrifice something, you also gain a lot. Like you can gain time, for instance, because you don't have to work as much. Maybe it's less stressful for you to have a smaller home where you don't have to maintain so much and you don't have to clean so many square meters, you don't have so many things, so there's not like all this mess.
There's a really intense status race in this city.
Mm-hmm.
How would this kind of architecture fit into that, do you think? It would require a paradigm shift, wouldn't it?
Yeah, maybe that the paradigm shift hasn't happened just yet, but I do feel, or I'm convinced, that it is going to happen. And then this is the communal meeting house.
Oh, this is interesting. Know. There's a voting system here where visitors can vote. What are you willing to share? Are you willing to share a garden, a car, a washing machine, an electric drill, or a bath? I assume sharing the bath, not while other people are in it, not that kind of sharing a bath.
No, just sharing the bathroom.
Yeah, that's the final frontier for me, I think. How about you?
Sharing a bathroom?
Yeah.
I already share it with so many people in my household, so I don't think that I could feel the difference.
But presumably they're like family.
No, I don't think I would mind so much, actually.
That was Sarah Hatler in conversation with Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth. And Living Better Lives runs until April the 18th, 2022. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24 with me, Georgina Godwin, and I'm joined now by my friend and colleague, my fellow presenter, Emma Nelson, who is in our Zurich studio. Good morning to you, Emma.
Good morning. Grey and cloudy, but full of sunshine to be with you this morning, Georgina.
Let's look at the future of work, because our futures, too, yours and mine, very much bound up with this. The FT has a long feature all about where did all the workers go? And certainly, I don't know about in Zurich, but when you look around here in London, every single shop window, every restaurant has notices advertising vacancies.
I've noticed that conspicuous absence actually in Zurich. When I was thinking about the article that I was going to talk about today, I sort of did a direct compare and contrast. And if there is a labour shortage in Zurich, you really can't see it because whatever is happening, it's incredibly discreet. There are no signs in shop windows saying, please come and help us. But it is absolutely stark, isn't it? When you wander down any street in the United Kingdom, every shop window wants you to go and work in there. I mean, I don't know about you, but I sometimes walk down there thinking, actually, maybe if I just step in, I could walk into another universe, because clearly people are needing to hire. And this is a problem in the United States, according to the Financial Times. All this week, the FT is doing a series of long reads into the future of work, which is, they're always incredibly good at doing this kind of stuff. And in the last 24 hours, two have come out. The one that that I'm talking about today is about the fact that in America, more than 4 million people left their jobs in September, and that is the highest number of people resigning in a single month since records began in 2001. The previous record was in August. And what is happening is it's all part of what's being called the Great Resignation. People aren't just leaving either to drop out of the labour market or to go and do something more creative. They're actually going to better jobs. Whether it be better paid, better roles, or even a completely different job that might be more fulfilling for them. And it's knocking America really quite off course.
And it's been called also COVID clarity.
Yes. What seems to have been happening is that people who've been stuck at home during the pandemic haven't been doing what everybody thought that was going to happen, that they were going to sit tight and hold on to their jobs as much as they could. What they were realising is that they didn't like their jobs in the first place. So in the old world, when you went to your office or you went to wherever you worked, but you did a lousy job or a job that didn't satisfy you, you would just carry on with it anyway because there was other stuff associated with it. But what seems to be happening is when people are sitting at their desks at home and have arguably a more pure experience of their jobs or of their work, they're deciding that they don't want it. So that's a good sign because people are still wanting to go into work. It's not the homeworking thing that's making people resign. It's just that they want to do a job that they enjoy. Now, I'm going to contrast this very briefly with an article that's appeared in the FT, their next instalment today, which seems to be this is a problem that is not happening in France. And this is good news for France because France has quite a lot of, has a history normally of slightly higher levels of employment than other highly developed countries. And the OECD has been surprised about this. What appears to be the reason for this is that in contrast to America, where when you were given your furlough, you claimed your benefit directly from the government, the money was given to companies in France. And as a result, companies could invest and retain and look after their employees, and managers would know that they would have a strong and steady workforce that would come back when things opened up again.
Mm. Now, the New York Times also has a take on this. They're asking what the link is between job vacancies and migration.
This is a really interesting story if you are interested in where people's working positions are coming from. And there's this described as a global battle for the young and able. There are images right through this book, this article, of immigrant trainees being shown how to do jobs. There's an example in Germany. There's an example in Canada. There's an example in Israel. And what's happening is that money and residency and better working conditions are being offered to immigrants. And as a result, it's sort of recalibrating the way that we see migration too, not just within the workforce, but within society.
Mm. I mean, it's desperately obvious here in Britain that we are suffering because of a lack of migrants.
Absolutely. And the jobs that the immigrants are coming to nowadays are better. So what is happening is that when you arrive from another country now, if you are going to a highly developed country, there is generally it's being made easier for you to settle. Immigrant workers are finding that they are being treated the same way as the rest of the population. And this article in the New York Times points very much to a contrast with the United Kingdom, where 7 out of 10 companies are now struggling to find employees. What seems to have happened is that pre-pandemic, the less paid areas of the labour market were very migrant based, and that's because people could move. And when COVID happened, people couldn't move anymore, and as a result, the countries which depended on lower paid younger workers found themselves with a massive gap. And the countries which are doing better are the ones who have decided to change their approach to migrant workers and treat them on the same level as the rest of the population.
So long overdue. I mean, I noticed the other day there was a notice in a restaurant window for a kitchen porter, which is sort of the lowest of the low in terms of the pecking order of employment within restaurants. And I thought, why on earth would you apply for that when you could be front of house and earn four times as much? I mean, it's just the labour market there is wide open, isn't it?
It's really strange because if you look at hospitality in the United Kingdom, this all dates back about 20, 30 years, actually, when maybe you can almost blame it on Tony Blair and the idea that everybody should go to university. And what happened is that 50% of people go to university now, or have done in the last few years. And as a result, when you leave university from the United Kingdom, you have a sense of entitlement that you want to start with a job, a car, a pension, a nice salary. You don't want to be polishing cutlery, making beds. But what seems to happen if you do work in other countries where things like hospitality are valued more, the thought of progress is a great incentive. So I know people who've run hotels in London who have said that they always hired from the European Union because people came in, didn't mind doing the dirty work to start off with, because they knew that within about 2 or 3 years they could be managing a hotel on £70,000-£80,000 a year. And that was what made people hungry.
Yeah. Well, let's look at hotels because you have a story here about a luxury hotel going super high tech.
This is wonderful and awful in equal proportion. So there's this marvellous hotel called the Dolder Grant, which is up on the Zürichberg, on the eastern side of the Zürichsee. And it has these glorious turrets. And it's one of Switzerland's top addresses. It's imposing. It prides itself on tradition and heritage. It dates back to 1899. There's art on the wall by the likes of Dali and Takashi Murakami. But it's gone super high tech. For starters, it's got its own playlist on Spotify. And I'll leave you to make your own mind up about this one. But to remove the need for regulars to show their paperwork, they scan your face and your COVID certificate by a camera, and then they save it. And then when it is registered as vaccinated and stored in your system, it means that next time you visit, you don't need to have that, where's your paperwork, where's this, where's that, where's the other, which I don't know about you, has been absolutely plaguing me every time I want to go somewhere at the moment, that I have to just hand over a pile of papers and hope that one of them is going to let me into the building I need to get into.
Oh, that sounds like such a good idea. I mean, you and I are kind of tag teaming in Zurich at the moment. I'll be there next week. I wonder if there's any way at all I could get into that hotel.
Have a go. I know where it is. I've walked up past it yesterday. But it sort of opened a bigger question for me, actually, that I like this idea of ease of entry, but a little bit of me thinks, okay, we're hearing of hotels now which are using an app so you can set your room temperature. You need an app to get in your room. An app will remember which gin and tonic you like. An app will guess what kind of food preferences are. And a bit of me thinks, whatever happened to someone saying, Frau Godwin, how lovely to see you again. I remember you from last month. I remember the gin. I remember the laughs. I remember that you like your room set at a rather steamy 28 degrees Celsius. Welcome back. And that kind of stuff is, I don't think you can really beat. I mean, great to have your facial recognition thing. Apparently, what's quite funny, though, is that there's a large debate here in Switzerland, as there is all over the world, about the storage of data and whether it's privacy and all this kind of stuff. And the Tages Anzeiger article that I'm talking about does have a large debate as to, you know, how much people can record of our faces and our personal data. Apparently, in this hotel, they've all just gone, yeah, fine, no problem, let me in.
Emma, we're almost out of time, but I just can't resist having a quick chat about goats.
There's always a good thing to talk about goats on Monocle 24. It is a fine, fine thing to talk about. Listen, there's no great commentary to be made about this. There's an article in the New York Times which talks about goats. Now, they're the mascot of the Naval Academy. And when every single year people try to steal each other's goats, because the armies have mules and the Navy have goats. And there's this wonderful list of all the things that people have done to try to steal each other's goats. This year, they did a terrible job of it because they tried to jump into a field to get the goat they needed. I think it was Bill number 37. All these goats are called Bill, by the way, dating back for years and years and years. Basically, they spooked all the goats. They ran across the field, grabbed the goat, got it back. Then started to boast about having the goat when they realised that they'd got the wrong goat. They had Bill 34. So they had, instead of the new super-duper young, fresh goat, they had an old retiree with arthritis and one horn. That is one example. I urge everybody to go and look at this article. There's nothing serious in it. It's just people being silly.
Very silly indeed. Emma Nelson, thank you very much indeed. And I'm sure it's almost time for us to get Andrew Muller's regular annual story on the Gavler goat, which gets set on fire every year. So I'm sure that'll be coming up at some point. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It's time now to talk urbanism with Urban Affairs commentator Kat Hannah. Kat, welcome back to The Globalist. We're going to start with The New York Times and park benches. What's this all about?
Yeah, so this was a lovely story, actually, although it'd be, I think, tinged with sadness, and really, I guess, a bit of a love letter to the park bench. And the author himself, Jonathan Lee, talks about growing up in a grey suburb of London, so maybe that's why it spoke to me. But again, talking about the role that park benches have played, really, I guess, in kind of fostering a sense of solitude, but also kind of community at the same time, and sort of highlighting how that the ability to have both is actually such an important part of urban living.
Mm, totally. And I think it's really important to have this sounds a bit silly, but a relationship with a particular bench, to have a sitting spot where you go regularly and a place to observe the world and the changing weather and so on from one particular static point.
Absolutely. And I'm sure if you asked a lot of people, they could probably identify, you know, what are their, you know, favourite benches. We obviously have the tradition of, you know, dedicating benches to people too as well. And I think, as you said, almost kind of commemorating the art of observation that, you know, a bench allows you to do. But also that it's not just observation that it can support, but also a range of activity as well. And there's a really nice part of the article where he talks about, you know, being in Central Park in New York, and again, seeing all the range of activities, you know, whether it's birthday parties, whether it's friends meeting up, whether it's someone sitting alone reading a book, but just the kind of humble park bench can support.
Just in a related story here in Britain, there's been a lot of media about a new calendar called Park Benches of Reading. And it's a man who just goes around taking pictures of benches in Reading. I believe he's also done the roundabouts of Reading, but they're flying off the shelves, we're told. Now, all new buildings in England will have electric car charge points from 2022. That is a huge leap forward.
It is a pretty big leap forward, and this is an announcement. The Prime Minister gave an interesting speech earlier this week.
Well, that's
CBI.
One way of describing it.
It's a whole other interview to probably cover that. But one bit of policy that actually did come out in that was this requirement of all new buildings in England, so that's things like your supermarkets, your office blocks, will be required to have EV charging. I think, you know, in many ways, I think a really positive step forward. I think personally, I'd say, you know, whilst it's a really important step, probably isn't the only thing that needs to be looked at when it comes to thinking about how our new buildings can actually support, you know, a kind of green lifestyle.
Mm. And I think we need to look at old buildings too, because, I mean, certainly on my street, there are two charge points and so many EV vehicles. It becomes impossible, in fact, to charge your car.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, that's a broader point, not just about EV, but actually this idea of retrofit, how we make, you know, our existing infrastructure or building stock up to scratch, rather than almost having kind of two tiers of assets where we'll have those that are really green and they've got all the latest technology and they're wonderful, and then those that maybe get left behind because it's actually harder often to go back in and put the right infrastructure in place.
Mm. Now, Bloomberg has a piece about the greenest cities in Europe.
Yeah, so this was a really nice write-up of quite a detailed study of 1,000 cities in Europe, looking really at this idea of, you know, what does it really mean to be a green city? So looking not just at the amount of green space, but actually how it's distributed amongst the population as well. So it's quite a kind of detailed methodology for that, but did actually yield some quite interesting results. Mm-hmm. So often those cities that visually strike us maybe as being very green, particularly ones maybe like Paris or Copenhagen, because of the kind of, you know, think of someone like Paris and the kind of large spaces that it has. Actually, when it comes to how this space is distributed, aren't necessarily as green as we might think. And I think, you know, that's something that we probably felt quite a lot in the pandemic as well, that the ability to access this space on your doorstep is important, not just having it in the city overall.
Yeah, I mean, Paris, maps of Paris are really misleading because it looks like there are these big green spaces, and in fact, they're not at all, are they?
Exactly. And I think what the report also points out is it's not just the green space on its own. It's also about, for example, having good quality, good air quality, or supporting active travel as well. You know, it's one thing having a park, but if everyone has to drive there and the air quality is appalling, you start obviously losing some of those benefits, whether it's to, you know, to mental health, whether it's to physical health, to the environment as well, if that green space, you know, isn't part of a kind of a network of measures to support, I guess, healthy urban living.
Yeah, and of course it's got to have a nice bench. Kat, is that a dog I can hear in the background?
It is, yeah. Someone's up and ready for his morning walk.
We're going to let you go and just make sure that he has that in a lovely green space and perhaps have a nice contemplative sit on a bench. Kat Hannah,
absolutely.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
This
Bye-bye.
Is The Globalist on Monocle 24. a red letter day for Finland's postal service. A new flagship space focusing on customer experience has opened in Helsinki city centre. And Petri Bertsoff has been to visit. Petri, tell us about the background of this 400-year institution.
Right, yeah. So Finnish Post is really one of the key and most loved public services in Finland. Finns use the services a lot. I was told yesterday, this actually surprised me a little bit, that Finns send just around Christmas about 18 million Christmas cards. That's, you know, for a nation of five million people. So, you know, we have a strong need for the postal services.
Mm-hmm. And describe the new building and all these new developments then.
Yeah, so the new building it's kind of actually a return to its origins. So this building was built in 1938, and it's actually called the Post House. It used to house the Finnish Post headquarters until 2003, when it was moved to the suburbs. But now it moved its main post office back to this post building in the center, and it's really lovely. I mean. How to describe the experience? I walked in yesterday, and as soon as you walk in, you're greeted by an actual human being, you know, not a machine, a human being who says hi to you and ask you how you are and what needs you have, and then directs you to these different service points in the post office. And there's, you know, you have these fully automated machines for dropping off parcels if you want, but you also have humans helping you pick cards and even give you a helping hand with writing a card and all kinds of really, I just like the human element in all of it.
Mm. And I understand that there's been a big advances in terms of lockers and parcel space.
Yeah, this is really where Posti, I think, is putting up a good competition against all these modern parcel services. So this is actually a second sort of a flagship that they opened in the center of Helsinki. They opened this box by Posti that we covered for Monocle as well. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, where, you know, it's essentially a space where you just pick up parcels and you can open them there. If you ordered clothes from e-retailers, you can try them on. You know, you can leave the packaging materials there, and it's just done in a really nice and stylish way, and they've actually incorporated elements of that in the new main postal office that just opened this week. But in addition to that, they also have traditional postal services, so, you know, you can send letters, you can buy stamps, you can buy cards and all kinds of nice traditional stuff as well.
Mm. And of course it has a great environmental policy.
Yes, well, of course, as always with modern Finnish companies, they're really keen to stress how what their environmental impact is, and I think they've achieved this not by planting trees and that kind of stuff, which seems to be the trend these days, but actually by, you know, when I go and pick up a parcel, I can just leave the cardboard boxes and everything there, and if I go to send something and I forgot to take a box for it, I can just take somebody's used box and they will help me clean it and package it. And that way, you know, we don't have to buy new boxes and materials all the time.
Mm. Finally, Petri, how will this impact Helsinki? And do you think that we'll see other organisations adopting this approach to business, this really hands-on, customer-led, very environmentally friendly way of operating?
You know, I do believe so. I think there is something of a return to the old times here. I mean, I just not only the human service that I experienced yesterday, but also just the way the whole space looked. I mean, they returned back to their old colors, this beautiful orange color that they've had historically, and the old logo. And of course, I mean, they wouldn't do that if there wasn't a need for that. I think people do miss this human service and talking to people. And of course, then also this environmental environmental footprint as well. So I think we will see other businesses copying it.
Mm, and you can actually sit there and write your cards and so on, can't you? I mean, it's a space to be in as well as just to pass through and do your business.
Yes, absolutely. I actually love that. So next to this, they have a dedicated section in the post office for buying cards, and there's a human being there that helps you pick the cards, as I said. And next to it, there are tables and chairs and I must say quite stylish lamps as well, sort of respecting the functionalist heritage of this mid-century building. And you can sit there and you can you know, take your time and write your greetings on the card and just be inspired instead of just, you know, leaning against the wall as you usually would do in a post office or just some bland desk. So that was nice.
Absolutely. Petri, thanks very much indeed. That was Monocle's Helsinki correspondent, Petri Bertsov. And that's all for today's programme. Thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds, Daniel Bache and Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researchers were Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. And our studio manager today is Chris Ablakwa. After the headlines, there's more music on the way. I'll be with you hosting that music and various interesting programmes from around our schedule. And then The Briefing is live at midday in London. And today that comes from Emma in our Zurich studio. And The Globalist will return at the same time tomorrow. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.